Good afternoon, folks. Jim Brookshire, Federal Circuit Bar. Great to have you with us this afternoon. The topic of today is a topic that is on the minds of each of us, no matter what your stage in life, because it's a topic about change and how to think ahead and what opportunities there are and evaluation of your current circumstance. There's no topic more important to our professional lives than that one. And embedded in it, of course, are the threads of how we wish to develop our careers, our allocations of work, family time, our allocations of goals in terms of areas of our life in which we wish to grow. But we are terrifically fortunate today, all of us around the country, to have this great group of individuals who represent firms, governments, and corporate opportunities. And I have had the pleasure of knowing some of these folks for a few years, so I know that they're having changes in their careers over the course of those years. My personal bias is that it's important to be comfortable with change, even if you decide not to take it. The idea of change can be a friend, although one has to get over the scary part of that. So beyond that editorialism, I'm going to turn it over to Lauren Dreyer right now, and Lauren, let you lead this discussion. There'll come a time at the end of the discussion where Lauren opens the lines for questions and answers. If you have any, just identify yourself, and I'm sure the panel will be glad to respond. Thank you all for taking the time in your day.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. We're excited to have this panel to talk about different opportunities outside of private practice today. This discussion is being hosted by the Law Clerks and Students Committee for the Federal Circuit Bar Association. And thank you to all of our panelists for joining us. I want to introduce them all. To my left, I have Molly Filson, who's an associate solicitor at the United States Patent Office, going to give us some government perspective about working for the PTO. And then next to her is Dan Girdwood, who is principal legal counsel for Samsung, one of our panelists who can talk both about in-house work and government work as well. To his left is Corey Salzberg, who is VP and global head of IP affairs for Novartis, who also has a diverse amount of experience in terms of private practice, government work, and in-house work. And then to his left is David Stark, who is a patent attorney at the U.S. Air Force and who also has great experience both in private practice and in government. So we're really fortunate to have these great four panelists today who have really diverse backgrounds and experiences and are willing to share with us a little bit. So let's start by just having each of you introduce yourself to everyone on the call and give us a little bit about your background from what you've done in your career after you graduated law school to where you are today. I know that's a lot to go over for some of you, but we'll get into more detail later. You can give us kind of a high-level overview. Could you start, Molly?
Sure. So my name is Molly Filson. So I went to law school thinking I wanted to do patent law. So I graduated and went to Finnegan. I worked there for a total of 5 years, although I left after 2 years and clerked at the Federal Circuit for Judge Lori. I was there for 2 years, went back to Finnegan, and then, so after another few years, I wound up at the PTO in the solicitor's office, and it was sort of a fluke. I was happily working at Finnegan, doing my thing. I had done a lot of different types of work over the course of those 5 years at Finnegan, so it had been some patent prosecution, some client counseling, a lot of litigation and a lot of different tribunals. So at district court, the ICC, in the Federal Circuit. And so I had sort of a breadth of experience, but I had sort of focused on litigation in the most recent few years. And so then a friend who was at the PTO emailed and said, hey, there's a spot opening in our office. Do you want to come work with me? And I said, well, I'll think about that. And so I submitted an application and kind of, it took a long time, actually. They didn't wind up hiring for the position that I applied for about more than 6 months. There was like a sequester. This is something that happens in the government where they just don't hire for a while.
Right, hiring freeze or yeah. shut down or
right,
something
exactly.
else unexpected.
So that was like a little awkward, but then I heard back from them after a while. I'd sort of forgotten about the application I submitted, and then they said, oh, actually, we want to interview you. So I went and interviewed, and I wound up there, and it's been great. I've been at the PTO for 5 years.
You just had your 5-year anniversary, right?
Yeah. I guess LinkedIn does that.
Yeah.
I spent about a year of that at the Department of Justice, which is, I guess we can talk about that later, but that's something interesting in the government that you can do is sort of do a detail, take some time doing a totally different job from the one that you normally do. So that was fun. But I've been in the government for a total of 5 years.
Okay, great. Thanks.
So I'm Dan Girdwood again. Depending on the day you ask, currently a principal legal counsel, mostly do IT-related work for Samsung. To go from law school on, I started out my IT career as a patent agent for Foley and Marvin in Washington, D.C., mostly doing patent prosecution while going to law school at night, and decided I wanted to try to do a little more litigation work, which started my Foley and Marvin-related career. I left with a group of attorneys to go to it was then Heller, Irwin, White, and McAuliffe, now defunct. I was at Heller for a couple of years, went to clerk on the Federal Circuit with Circuit Judge Rader at the time. Left Federal Circuit to go back into private practice at what was then Steptoe & Johnson, still Foley and Marvin related colleague moving around. I was there for a couple of years before I got to the point in my career where I decided I really needed more stand-up courtroom experience. Which is very hard to get in a law firm environment. Speaking as a Samsung person, I could say that we're not really bringing a big case and asking a mid-level associate to argue the big motion and take the big witness. So I was looking for government opportunities that would give me that. And some friends and former colleagues at the International Trade Commission coaxed me to come over as a trial attorney in the Office of Unfair Import Investigation there. Spent 4 years at the commission. Actually did one of the within agency details. I was drafted to go up and spend a few months with Commissioner Aronoff as her aide in a different role within the agency for a while. After 4.5 years at the commission, was getting to the point where I kind of figured out the trial thing and was looking for another experience again, and a former ITC colleague of mine who was at Samsung had been pushing very hard for me to go Samsung. So I left the commission to join Samsung in 2012, I think it was, so about 6 years ago now. And I've been with the company ever since. Doing mostly litigation related, but the role certainly does vary a lot on any given day. That's my brief path.
Great. Corey?
Hi, everyone. I'm Corey Salzberg. I guess the way I like to tell the story, and some people go to law school to become Perry Mason or Sandra Day, you know, some people follow a guy or a girl to law school, like in Legally Blonde. I basically went to law school because of a sheep, a clone sheep, Dolly. It was in the 1990s, I had, 1997, had finished college with a undergraduate degree, liberal arts, a senior thesis on time travel in film and literature, so I didn't know what I was going to do with that. I had a real interest in science fiction, actually, so all this big news of cloning animals and that kind of a thing. I thought it was fascinating. There was a whole legal and ethical debate, you might remember, about this topic at the time. I wanted to get involved, but I was not a scientist by training. So, of course, law school made a lot of sense. I went out and went to Stanford for law school, which was one of the only programs in the country, my knowledge at that time, that was really focused on technology of that sort in the core curriculum. So that was kind of what I wanted out of law school. And I spent my time focusing on that kind of thing, I had the chance to write a law review article on the ethics and law of cloning big species with woolly mammoths and things like that were in the news at the time, even though it has not quite happened that way yet. At that point, though, I realized I had a lot of student loans to pay off. So,
as we all eventually come to realize.
And originally, my plan was actually to go into counseling for the life sciences industry. But all of those opportunities, the way things work sometimes in the world, dried up because of the tech bubble burst in the year 2000. So that kind of forced me to reevaluate. I ended up taking a job as a patent litigator with Morrison & Foerster in San Diego. Because patent litigation was kind of a very, very active and up-and-coming field at that time. Was not really hurt by the recession of the time period. If anything, was probably helped by it, because when companies stopped making money from selling products, they sued each other. So I spent about 5 years doing that in California, and then moved back to Boston, where I spent a year litigating in a boutique, IP boutique, which is no longer around. And then went over to McDermott & Emery in Boston as well. At that point, I started realizing, you know, I never really went to law school to be a litigator in the first place, so maybe it's time to find something else. And started looking around, I applied for all kinds of jobs. I actually was down here interviewing for the Smithsonian. Didn't get that job, which is one of my life lessons. But eventually I ended up finding an opportunity with a then client, which was one of the divisions, former divisions of Novartis, and that's how I ended up here. So it's kind of my career in a nutshell.
Yeah, great. All right, David?
Hello, everyone. I'm David Stark. So like Molly, I went to law school, wanted to do patent law. After law school, I moved out to BC and worked at Gavin Arps for a year, doing some patent litigation, but mostly general litigation. Then I went to clerk at the Federal Circuit for Judge Lori for 2 years. After that, I went to a firm called Paul Weiss. I was trying to bolster my litigation experience because after only working for a year and then clerking for 2 years, I didn't have much kind of hands-on litigation work. And Paul Weiss gave me the impression that I would have a lot of that. So I went there for 3 years, litigated in district court, ITC, Federal Circuit, got a lot of really great hands-on experience, but kind of after the birth of my second child, I was hoping to find a job that had a little bit more of a regular schedule. As great as private practice is and all the great opportunities you get, the certainty in your schedule is not really a strong point of the big law firm. So I just started looking around. It was kind of looking at government opportunities, and if you search for patents in USA jobs, not many things come up, so it's really easy to kind of go through and browse and see what's available. And maybe in May of last year, a job at the Air Force popped up on USA Jobs, and that sounded interesting. It was not really something I kind of thought of, but it was the description sounded fun, and I've always kind of been interested in working for the government, so I applied. Somehow my resume went through the various government screening tubes that they have. I was called in for an interview maybe about 2 months later, so not as long as you, Molly, but similar. After the interview, took about 3 to 4 months to finally get the offer and, jumped on it. It was kind of like a great opportunity. It sounded like it would be a lot of interesting work and, get a lot of hands-on courtroom experience, but also have a more regular balanced schedule. So I've been there for about a year. I joined in January. My start date was actually on the government shutdown, so that delayed me by 2 days. So I've been there about 10, 11 months now, and it's been great so far.
Okay, great. So David and Molly both talked a little bit about how when you're applying for the government job, it may actually take a little bit of time to actually wrap that up. I wondered, Dan and Corey, did you have the same experience when you were applying for your in-house job? Is there that same kind of built-in time period that it takes to, from the moment that you're out there submitting your resume to the time that you are getting your job offer?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was looking, at, as I said before, I kind of spent my entire 9 years at law firms looking
you're telling our audience it takes 9 years sometimes.
It can take 9 years. I mean, it really depends what you're looking for and what kind of you know, job, not just what you're looking for, but what your skill set is. So I, being a litigator, and yes, other litigators I know here too on the panel, being a litigator is sometimes a little more challenging than, you know, if you're just doing the kind of corporate work or even a patent attorney where lots of, you know, corporations of a certain type may be hiring patent attorneys. Not as many are hiring litigators, and even fewer hire people to do jobs that are not just managing litigation. You kind of want to do a mix of things. I did start at Novartis, I should say, as a litigator, but, you know, kind of a mix of different things, including litigation. But I will say, long before I took that job, as I mentioned, I was looking all over the place. This Smithsonian job is one of those USA Jobs things that came up. Obviously, a very unique position. Lots of people, I'm sure, applied for it. I was looking for a lot of diversity in an in-house role. I just like, you know, my background in terms of not being specialized in any one thing, I wanted a role that also was kind of all over the place in a way. So for me, it did take quite a while. I was always looking at things. And then, of course, when you find something you do want, most of the time, life being what it is, it doesn't necessarily work out just because you want a job and you get it. You may not even get called back. So I guess it's definitely an investment. It's something you have to take seriously. And I guess I know we'll get a little later to some advice we get to people. But one piece of advice to think about now is, I mean, I think it's important to think about where you want to be eventually, what kind of things you're looking for, and make a move that brings you closer to it instead of just making a move to change what you don't like about what you do now, because you may otherwise find yourself, you know, further away from your goals if you're just doing things because something comes up. Mm-hmm. So that's my view.
That certainly would be consistent with my view. You can take a step back. Sure. My path was a little bit different than Corey's. I wasn't searching for 9 years for a job. I was pretty happy at the commission, and it just got to the point where I just sort of feeling like, you know, maybe I'm ready to get a different experience in my career. And I had a former colleague that had been hounding me for a year and a half or whatever. So for me personally, it was actually very quick. We happened to have a large group of senior executives that were visiting another trial at the commission that happened to be in town. And finally, showed some, you know, interest in the position. It's like, okay, can you show up on Tuesday? And they walk in and there's 16 executives at a conference table, and then a couple of days later there's a talk. A colleague of mine that I was able to bring in had sort of the opposite experience. We were trying to find somebody for a number of years. I reached out to him, and it took probably 6 months to actually bring him on board.
At Samsung.
Yeah. Despite us actually pursuing him and him showing interest in it. It was a little bit of just works in the corporate management. There was time to not really sure whether they wanted to expand or not. It took some time to convince people that was indeed a need. So once we sort of immediately had a candidate, and then took a while to actually convince management to agree to go along.
I should add really quickly, so one of the dumbest things I ever probably did was I got to a point where I actually quit my law firm. Without having an empty move lined up.
That's not a good idea.
Probably not a good idea in hindsight, but, I was just at a point mentally where I was ready to be done, and it worked out for me, but in hindsight, it's one of those things, especially since I had my first child at that moment, my wife was ready to kill me, so.
I was going to ask the area at the time.
I was, and I barely hung on.
Other than getting grief from your family at home, was it, did you have any difficulty lining up your next job while currently being not employed by a law firm in terms of the claiming a gap or anything like that?
Not so much because I ended up going to a former client, but it took me a while. I waited in between because I was exploring other things. And I would say that, that is definitely a risky thing to do, and I would not recommend it. Again, in hindsight, I was just at the time kind of hot-headed about it. I wasn't happy, so I was ready to do that. But my advice to everyone now, including, you know, I've been in situations since then where I've changed internally, but I've learned my lesson. I'd advise not to do that.
Just for your own sanity.
Yeah, I mean, it can be stressful, and it also, like you said, there have been various questions about that. So.
Well, I have a good friend of mine who had that experience recently. He left his law firm, took him almost a year and a half to find another position. He was very much looking for an in-house job. Eventually got so desperate he took something that just happened to come in. I was there only for 2 weeks before he got the in-house job, and then left it in-house. But he has said that it made it a lot more challenging.
Yeah.
Because some, not all, but some companies do ask, some firms do ask, if the government hires would ask it, to explain the gap.
Right. Fairly standard, common question from an interviewer. So let's talk a little bit about what you find the differences to be between your experience that you've had in private practice and what you're doing on a day-to-day basis in your current roles, either in-house or in government. Molly, do you want to start us off?
Sure. So I guess I should explain what I do.
Yeah, I could have started that way. What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
So what I do is mostly litigating for the PTO on substantive patent or trademark matters. So it's usually in the federal circuit, people appealing from the denial of their patent application or from losing in a post-grant proceeding will represent the agency on the other side in court. So so most of what I do is writing briefs, arguing cases at the federal circuit. There are other kinds of litigations that we're involved in as well. So sometimes people will sue the PTO under the Administrative Procedure Act or under other provisions where we end up in district court. So we can end up usually in the Eastern District of Virginia, but even that sometimes is in other, usually not in Oregon, but sometimes it's in the home state of the applicant. So it can be anywhere in the country, actually. So we do a little bit of litigating in all the district courts.
Does the government staff those with the attorneys in the solicitor's office or with DOJ attorneys?
It's usually a mix. So we will partner up with the U.S. Attorney's Office in the district where we're litigating. And depending on the district and their staffing and lots of other factors, it may be us running the litigation with them sort of advising, or it may be the other way around. And it also depends on the issues in the case. There's sort of a lot of things that go into that. So
sure.
And
so I guess for our audience, like what percentage of your work is more in the federal circuit and what percentage is more district court litigation? So I guess between appellate and trial work.
Yeah, it's probably 80% appellate,
okay.
I think, and 20% trial litigation. And then there's other things that we do that are not litigation. So we're also the sort of, in a sense, we're the in-house counsel for the PTO. So we give advice on sort of guidance or things that come up at the PTAB or sort of in any
in
of
terms
the other
like the rulemaking or
in rulemaking and just sort of promulgating any kind of like rules or internal guidance. And then also,
do you have any input on the guides that they publish to patent examiners as well?
Yeah,
for evaluating 101 or something.
Like yeah, that? So like the MPEP gets revised periodically, and we weigh in on that also.
Okay.
So that's sort of an aspect of what I do. And then one other aspect of what I do is deciding whether or not to weigh in litigation. Mm-hmm. So both in district court and in the federal circuit. And a lot of it is in the federal circuit when there are two parties in an inter-parties proceeding, and one appeals, the other is there to represent the other side, so then it's a question of whether or not we want to weigh in.
Right.
And we have the authority to intervene, but we don't intervene in every case because we just don't have the staff to do that, or that, you know, there isn't really the need for us to do that.
Right.
So there's a process that everybody in the solicitor's office is involved in deciding whether or not we weigh in litigation. So that's sort of, in a sense, advisory, in a sense, a litigation role.
And are a lot of those things group efforts in terms of weighing in on the MPEP or the guides or deciding whether to intervene? Is that something that's done collectively as your group, or are you assigned a specific case to decide whether to intervene on? And it's more of a one-on, you know, your task.
It tends to be that an individual attorney is tasked with a specific case, but we kind of have a sense of who else in the office has expertise in certain issues, and so if an issue comes up where I know a certain colleague has a lot of knowledge about that issue, then certainly, like, we team up with other people. And then in terms of the way our cases are run, it's always a team, usually of two, on a litigation. So where one person is the principal attorney on the case and they choose their second, and then, you know, both are available to work on the case because, you know, it's usually the principal attorney who will write the brief and an appeal, and the second will review it, and then the principal will usually argue the case. And so that's sort of how it shakes out. But there's always, there is a fair amount of teamwork in terms of, like, you always have somebody to bounce ideas off of, and, like, yeah, so that's helpful. But, so that's some background, but then, so what was...
Let me put a pin in my first question, which was
sure.
Differences between private practice.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Let's talk about what everyone kind of does on a day-to-day basis, and then we can collectively talk as a group about the differences. So, can I turn it over to you, Dan?
Sure. So my job is, it's probably 70% litigation management.
Okay.
And we're a little bit unique for my private practice days as a company that I work with. Samsung tends to be very hands-on. The most simple way to describe it is we're kind of a second chair to all of the cases. So obviously we're not going to see the confidential business information of whoever we're litigating against. We can't see all of ours. So I do extensive brief writing and rewriting. I do extensive witness prep. We attend almost all of the big hearings, whether it's claim construction or appeal or trial or discovery disputes. That's about 70%. Probably 10 to 15% is appellate work. So I personally have a lot of appellate experience from prior to my Samsung career. So if I have a colleague who's had a case and at the appellate stage, whether we're appellee or appellant, I'll often get brought in to work on the appeal. And that's, you know, brings me before the court quite a bit, which I do enjoy because it's my time there. And then 20% is other. And other has a really big, very squishy, broad meaning. I've had days where I get a phone call in the morning and it says, there's a congressional hearing on X that's of some interest to some IP-related issue, or we've got a meeting with a Hillsacker about patent office reform, or there's a meeting with, you know, Jeffrey Yonker or somebody at the PTO to talk about either from the patent owner side or the litigation side. And then we also have all of the other kind of things that come up. You know, Samsung is a little bit of a unique company in that while we all recognize it for washing machines and cell phones and laptops, we're actually a really big component maker. And that comes with indemnification demands. And that's a whole different side of these as well. So, you know, 70-80% is pretty predictable litigation in the field related, and then there's that really big squishy 20% of what big landline came in that did.
And why do the things that fall into that 20%, why do they land on your desk versus someone else's desk at Samsung?
Sometimes it's wrong place at the wrong time.
You showed up to work that day?
Some of it is actually, I find more often than not, happy relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's actually been a big part of my career in general is when you've shown interest and expertise in this particular area, you'll often get called upon for certain things. So I've been with the company now long enough that I have a lot of relationships with people in Korea, certain business units and certain colleagues that they look to me for advice and help when they don't have to. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the squishy special projects come from that, from having earned the trust of colleagues over the years to be asked. In fact, it's part of the job that's perhaps the most interesting in the world because it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And allows you to continue to build yourself up experience-wise and make the job a little less mundane.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so I, as I mentioned, started at Novartis originally doing litigation, but I've been there about 9 years now. And shortly after I joined, I started getting involved. It was around the time of the America Invents Act. So I started getting involved in policy work at that point in terms of analyzing what was happening, you know, working with our government affairs people on the Hill. And I started to develop really a career and totally shifted out of litigation over the years and to the point where I am today, where I built kind of a function within our IP function and legal function that's called Global IP Affairs, and we're focused on IP policy and IP advocacy. So we're looking at patent systems around the world, legislative changes, policy trends. In addition to my role, you know, I do a lot of advising on litigation or proceedings where there are policy dimensions, everything from compulsory licensing threats in developing countries to, you know, biosimilar biologic issues that arise here in the U.S. My day-to-day, like many of you probably, there's no such thing as a normal day. Sometimes we'll do amicus briefing, either completely in-house or working with our association. We do a lot of work with our trade association. We do work with cross-industry associations like IPO and Federal Circuit Bar. Do a lot of speaking, and kind of sponsoring of workshops and seminars in countries where we're trying to educate lawmakers and judges and local counsel about, you know, the value of IP and the dangers of weakening IP systems and the harms that it causes to innovation and access to medicine. A lot of work because of, you know, the pressures on access to medicine and pricing around the world, including here in the U.S. Briefing of our, you know, most senior executives on key IP issues. List goes on and on. We do proactive initiatives, so I've been fortunate to have been deeply involved in building this pro bono patent program that we run through WIPO, where we're working with developing country inventors to try to get them to use patent systems, to try to develop trust in the patent system over the long run. Other, you know, proactive industry initiatives. So it's kind of a whole mix of different things, which is probably one of the main reasons I'm still there. I get bored pretty easily, you know, in terms of personality, maybe probably like many of us. And for me, the diversity, the fact that it's always changing, global role, is really kind of part of the recipe of making it interesting enough that I stuck with the job and still enjoy it.
Sure. But how many of those things that you named, how much of that are you overseeing sort of in a supervisory role? And then how much of it is your day-to-day work product that you're putting together?
So a lot of it's doing. I have a team of just 10 to 12 people around the world that do various aspects of it. But, you know, I'm the only one really focused on doing most of it in the U.S. As I mentioned, a lot of traveling. So I was in Brazil 2 weeks ago. I was in Paris 3 weeks ago. I travel all over the world. It may sound, you know, exotic and fun. And it is for the 3 hours that you go get to have dinner. But there's a lot. It's a huge world. And, of course, you know, there are others, you know, who work on my team who do lots of stuff, too. But there's so much to do in the world of IP policy, particularly for our industry, that it's amazing to me that we're one of the few companies that has actually dedicated people in a role like mine. Because I could fill my day, and this goes back to the question, which I guess we'll get to a little bit more after. Some people always assume that if you're in-house, you know, you've given up the hard life of law firm work and your you know, your hours and your lifestyle is real easy. And the truth is there's so much to do in these jobs that you could easily fill 24 hours in a day and not get it all done. So you have more control for sure, but you really have to pick and choose, and you're really based on what you're trying to achieve. It's objective driven rather than, you know, hours or input driven. I'd say it's a mix. So it's definitely overseeing some, but doing a lot of others.
Right. And you said you had started at Novartis in litigation, but you do more policy work now.
Yeah.
I wonder, was that, how long were you doing litigation before you phased into other outside of litigation fields? And was that move intentional on your choice?
Yeah, definitely intentional. I did litigation for about a year and a half full time. I started with Novartis in New York City, which is our U.S. corporate headquarters. Shortly after that, less than 2 years in, I actually moved over to Basel, our headquarters in Switzerland. So that's another great aspect of working for a big multinational company. I got to live in Switzerland for 5 years.
It's hard to complain about that.
Hard to complain, you know, unless you don't like eating your chocolate. And beer, right? Exactly. So, fondue I can pass on. When I went over to Basel after a little under 2 years, I expressed, you know, one of my demands when I went over that I wanted, after, as I mentioned, getting involved a little bit in American Dentact, I really wanted to do more of that work because I found it so interesting. And I realized that there was so much going on in other countries as well, and some people were doing it. Not that it was completely ignored, it's just that it wasn't kind of formalized and dedicated the way that I saw value to the business in doing that. And that's another good lesson that I've learned, because most companies, if you can make a good business case as to why you should be doing other things, you know, you can at least make the argument that you want to get involved in these things and that they should be supported.
Right.
And so that's how I got more and more into it. And, you know, from there, it just kind of took off. So definitely intentional, and definitely about 2 years in, I started doing it. I'd say it became full-time 3 or 4 years into my 9 years there.
Okay, great. And David, describe to us what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Good thing. Apologies at the start. I just wanted to do a standard government disclaimer. I don't think I'm going to get in any controversial views, but just as a user of my own, I don't represent the United States government or the United States Air Force. So that being said, I'll
get the legalese out of there.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. I'm new to government, so I want to, you know, make sure I cover. So as with everyone else, my day-to-day varies greatly, but roughly kind of a third of my job is what I like to kind of bill as in-house type work. Me and my organization are the kind of IP focal point for a lot of the Air Force bases, and so we'll have various intellectual property-related questions bubble up from bases across the country on trademarks, on patents, copyrights, trade secrets, just pretty much anything can come up to us. And so, you know, these bases are just looking for some guidance. They want us to review some facts and kind of give them either things to look into or just kind of a quick opinion on what's going on. And in that role, there are also administrative claims that patentees can file against the Air Force, accusing the Air Force of patent infringement. And so when those administrative claims are filed, they come to my department and we look into it and do an investigation into these claims.
Mm-hmm.
That's roughly a third. The next third is working with the DOJ on federal litigation. So if an intellectual property holder, usually a patentee, but it can be a copyright holder or a trademark holder, sues the Air Force for patent infringement, the DOJ will take that case and handle the day-to-day litigation, but the Air Force will come in and help out with whatever is needed. And oftentimes, these cases aren't just a patentee suing the Air Force. They can be suing the Navy, the Department of Homeland Security. If there's a specific technology being accused, it's often shared or at least replicated across the government. So, you know, you can have these large cases where you have 10, 15 agencies all represented. And so DOJ will kind of be the quarterback for that case, but we'll come in and represent the Air Force and handle any sort of discovery that has to happen, help out with any sort of legal theories that, you know, that affect the Air Force. And also we'll do whatever the DOJ wants us to do to help. If they want us to take a deposition, you know, we're happy to. If they just want us to get documents and review briefs, we're happy to do that as well. And then the last third is a IP-based government contracts litigation at the Armed Services Board of Contract Appeals. Those are the cases that I get to handle first chair by myself, which is a new experience, and it's been interesting. It's been fun to kind of get that more senior role, which I didn't have at the firm, and also kind of lets me be a kind of decision maker in the cases, which is a new experience for me.
Yeah, my follow-up question was going to be, especially to you, since you're the closest one to private practice, having just joined the Air Force, you said 11 months ago or so.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest differences between private practice and your current role, either in government or in-house? And I'll open this up to the panel for discussion, but I'd love to start with you since you're the closest to your private practice job. You probably have a sense of that you might remember more than everyone else what you like being private practice.
Well, I see my family now. I saw my family before, just at odd hours.
Yeah, and I would love for everyone to talk about, we've alluded to it earlier in the conversation, but whether being in-house or in government really does mean less work, less hours, more of a work-life balance, those things that you do here.
I think for me, the nice thing is, in my government role, I'm a little more senior than I was at the firm. I was kind of a mid-level associate at the firm, so I was starting to run cases, but definitely, you know, still in the firm hierarchy. But in the government, I'm a much more senior individual in the cases. Oftentimes, I'm, you know, the senior attorney running the case. So it's easier for me to manage my schedule because I can make the decisions and kind of know what's coming down the pipeline. There aren't as many surprises, I think, in government litigation. The schedule tends to be more defined, and you don't have as many fire drills as you might have in district court litigation between private parties. So that, you know, I can win with everyone else. You know, you still work a decent amount, but I'm able to kind of manage my schedule and prioritize things that you might not have the ability to do as a associate law firm, where you have demands from various partners and various cases pop in and out. So.
Anyone else want to speak to their experience?
Sure. I mean, it's a very, very different experience. Just to address, you know, the question that I know is on a lot of people's minds that you mentioned, you know, the hours question. Without any question, I work more hours now than I ever did in any of my law firms, but they're very different hours. They're not hours that I'm looking to make quotas. And I'm not suggesting people invent hours. I'm saying, though, that you have a drive and pressure, and I remember it, you know. That's what you do in a law firm. You're selling.
You have a productivity measure, metric, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're, you know, hopefully filling that time with valuable work for your clients, but you're expected to, you know, do that because that's what you're selling, you know, when you get down to the business model of the firm in large part. And, that's totally gone from, you know, in-house roles, at least in my experience. I mean, there's not, you're putting in time because there are things you need to get done and things that you know, working for your work. And that is liberating, at least for me, and very liberating that you're, you know, you're working because you're trying to get the thing done rather than you're thinking about how long it's taking. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't cross your mind. So that's, you know, really important difference. And control as well. I mean, even in my role, I do travel a lot, but I even notice times, most of the time I can choose whether or not I do the trip. I'm at a point now where I only actually go and travel and will participate in things when I really feel there's going to be an impact or a benefit. I don't do a lot of traveling, you know, for something that just because I get invited. So definitely more control. In terms of differences, you know, kind of big picture, very different environment. You know, of course, people always talk about the fact that you're part of a business, and that's really true. You're trying to do things that make sense for your clients, just like you would in a law firm, but you're invested much over the longer term. So, you're not on a case, you're not on a matter, you're not starting in the middle and ending, you know, when you achieve X, Y, Z. If you stay long enough, you're really part of, you know, the ultimate objectives of your whole company. And that's really rewarding, I think, for most people who go in house, you know, on the corporate side. And I imagine for the government as well in some way. So those are some, but I'll turn it over to
Well, and let me ask a follow-up question, because Corey, both you and Dan have been at your respective companies for several years now. Did you find that you said that you work more now than you ever did before? Was that true when you first started at Novartis and Samsung, or is that something that's happened as you've become more senior in your particular position?
That's a really good question. For me, I definitely worked less when I first started. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, so it does depend in part on your role, what kind of work you're doing and how.
And what types of responsibilities, I'm sure, you're in charge of.
And how big your department is. I mean, if you're the sole attorney at a small startup, you're probably working, you know, 24 hours a day from the beginning. If you're joining a 500-person legal department worldwide where you're, you know, you're relatively junior and you're task-based, I don't know, but maybe you're, certainly my experience, I joined at a much lower level than I am now at Novartis, and I definitely worked less. I'd say, yeah, maybe, I don't remember exactly what it was comparable, but definitely less than today, and more has come and more responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's been bad hours since day one. you've
been embroiled in a lot of litigation.
To pick up on Corey's point, the product of the company, the type of, you know, in our office, the most junior person to join our office joined as a partner.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have like an inverted associate partner. There may be such people on prosecution rules. Not in the role that we have. And so when I joined with the expectation that I would be able to manage things, do what needed to be done to get them managed. And that's continued to this day. I would also say that, from my personal experience in government, the hours were also not better than private practice. Actually, my easiest hours from my private practice days
the government job that I had was counseling at AUII, and a lot of the colleagues that I had at AUII and the National Trade Commission were first year litigators, no matter what they had. It was a full time first year litigation job. So you were an army of one litigating against law firms and 20 or 30 people. So I would echo Corey's comment that the most liberating thing that's not this way is the suspended bill of the room. I don't track my hours, but that's in part because there's more than 24 hours of work to do, and if one of them is more than to do it. The bigger challenge, I think, is, as Corey also alluded to, in the company, you have to, there's a business justification for what you're doing. Whether you're continuing to litigate a matter, or whether you're dealing with selling off a business, or whether you're trying to reach some sort of licensing agreement, or whether you want to invest in government lobbying or outreach related efforts, there has to be a business justification. And that is not really a skill set you come to the corporate environment with. And it's definitely a bit of a learning curve to understand how to speak at the table with people whose job it is to make profit. Not always are the lawyers those people. You need to let them take the burden of that. That was a big change for me, and one of the challenges, in a good way, corporate
school. Yeah. So I guess one thing I would add is I agree with what the rest of you have said, which is it depends a lot on the role. So, for example, most of what I do in the solicitor's office is appeals, and so it does make the schedule really predictable. It's pretty easy to sort of know what your deadline is way in advance. You can, if you need it, you can take an extension because, you know, you have different deadlines lining up at the same time. So it is, and you're controlling your own litigation and your own schedule. So for the most part, that does actually mean you can keep your hours to a reasonable schedule. It doesn't mean that you're not working and that you're not working hard, but it is really nice in terms of your, you know, sort of work-life balance. It, it does depend on what you're doing. So when I'm in district court and, you know, going to trial, it's still trial and it still takes up all of my time. But, you know, it depends on what's going on at the moment, I think.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the interplay between your experiences in private practice and what you're doing now. I think you all have been in private practice, maybe a couple of different law firms. Do you think that your experience there was beneficial to your role now? And for any of our listeners who are thinking about future careers, either in-house or in government, would you recommend that they go into private practice first? I'll just open it up to whoever wants to answer first.
I mean, I would definitely, I guess as the person who was closest to private practice, I would definitely say the experience in private practice was beneficial. You know, if anything, just, you know, the learning kind of how to litigate, learning, you know, how to craft a motion, how to be persuasive, that's always important. And then also, I think, you know, as people alluded to, private practice, you have demands from partners and cases and deadlines that kind of pop up in and out, and this ability to prioritize and focus on what needs to happen first is just a valuable skill to have. And, you know, regardless of where you go, it's good to have that ability to kind of manage your schedule and make sure that what needs to get done gets done, and what can potentially be pushed to later can do that, so you can make sure that everyone that you're working with is happy. So that kind of skill set is invaluable, and, you know, it's not exclusive to private practice, but that's where I picked it up. So that, I think that was a valuable skill.
Maybe just building on that, for one thing, we, and I think most companies from the corporate perspective, don't hire people without a significant amount of experience in law firms. As I mentioned, I had been about 9 years in firms before I actually went in-house. Doesn't mean you have to have that much, but I know even a huge company like ours, I don't know of anyone who, you know, has been hired into our company as a lawyer, at least, without several years of outside counsel practicing experience. We just don't invest. I mean, of course, you learn and train in certain ways, but we don't train new lawyers how to be lawyers from the beginning. So that's one thing.
Right. You'd rather the private law firm spend their dollar training the young lawyers how to be lawyers. It's a vicious cycle.
But then in terms of skill, I agree. I mean, I the way I try to describe it, of course, you know, it sounds like all of us have litigation backgrounds. But for me, it's, you know, same show, different audience. Even on the policy side, I spend a lot of time speaking, and when I'm not publicly speaking, you know, in panels and talks, I'm speaking or advocating often, you know, with policymakers or lawmakers. And it's the same thing in a lot of ways as arguing to a jury or to a judge, you know, or to your client, you know, persuading your client that this is the right way to go. So all of those skills and advocacy skills are absolutely, I use every single day. And there's also even more formal examples, like I said, and I still do amicus briefs, I'll write them myself. I was largely a brief writer at my firm. So without any question, I could not do the job I have today without spending a significant time.
I think what I would say is, it doesn't necessarily have to be a firm, but you do have to have good mentorship and education before you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got several friends and several close friends and colleagues that went straight to government, even out of law school and coaches, and got that mentorship and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very fortunate, I think, like Corey, you were too, to be at a law firm that provided good mentorship.
Yeah.
And gave me good opportunities up to a certain point in my career. But I wouldn't say it has to be a firm. I would say it's important to find yourself in a position where you can get good opportunities, good experience, good mentorship, to be able to leverage that into another career.
Mm-hmm.
I think I agree with all of what the rest of you have said. I think for me, one thing that I found really valuable about the law firm, and this depends on the law firm, but for me it was, you could try a lot of different things at the law firm, which I feel like is maybe a little less available in other jobs, where it's sort of, you know, like I could do patent prosecution and litigation and counseling sort of all at the same time and try them all out. I know not all law firms offer that, but I really...
I have to leave one law firm for another because... There are certain firms that are like that, and there's other firms that are like, you're a prosecutor.
Right, it depends on
what you want to be, whether you want to have a lot of different types of experience or you want to focus on one thing, maybe important for a law firm.
Right. But the other thing I would add is that it does, in the government, depend on the government job also a bit. So, like, the Department of Justice has most of its job openings, I think, from out of the honors program, which is you have to either be right out of law school or right out of a clerkship. You cannot have worked at a law firm first. And they do a lot of mentoring and, you know, advising, and you get a lot out of that. And so I guess that's the one caveat I would give, is that in certain types of jobs, sort of, it's not only available to people coming right out of school or a clerkship, but that's the predominant way to get there.
Well, even, you know, there are state commission that I was at, within that agency, there were several different types of attorneys and attorney roles, and they brought people with different skill sets. The trial group that I was in tended to only hire people that were at counsel partner level. The attorney advisors on the general counsel's office would still hire experienced lawyers, but not necessarily that experience level. It might be more of a mid-level or senior counsel. Even within it, in an agency, that's obviously very important to do.
As I noticed that we're already nearing the end of our hour, which is amazing because we have so much more to talk about and all of your experiences, but what would be one piece of advice, or you think the most important piece of advice to give to new lawyers or next-gen lawyers or even lawyers who've been in their career for a little while but are looking to make a leap?
I mean, I guess the advice I would give is to be open to opportunities that come along and just sort of explore them. So, you know, you don't necessarily know where it's going to come from, and sometimes it's within your law firm or where you're currently working that there are opportunities to try something different, or sometimes it's from outside, from people you know from other jobs or law school, any number of things. But it's always, I feel like, been helpful to me to kind of not always say yes, but always be open to saying yes when you hear of these opportunities.
Basically not keeping the door closed. Door always open.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll repeat a piece of advice to Greta Lee that I found very helpful in my career, is to always make sure you learn. If you're not learning, it's time to learn. Whether that's to a different organization or a different role within the organization, or maybe to add more responsibilities, or to add features, or to do something pro bono on side, but to always be learning the job. Mm-hmm. Because even within an organization, if you go independently, you may have to. You may decide to want to for geographic reasons, for family reasons, or whatever. I've tried to embrace that in my career, and it's served me very well. Very much appreciated that. I'm very lucky, but the points in my career where I made the moves were in part of that in mind. So I left the law firm for the government in part because I felt and when I was leaving the government to go to the corporation, it was important because I felt I was trying to produce.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So aside from not quitting until you have something else like I would say don't underestimate the value of networking. I know you hear that a lot, but I think it's really true. There are a lot of jobs, including in our own company, that are, you know, going to a job board or just, you know, listening to what the headhunters call you with is only about half the universe, kind of like the dark web of employment. There's a whole world of jobs that come about that don't even get advertised and posted because someone already knows someone who they think, you know, would be good for the job or someone, you know, there's a relationship. And then related to that also, I think, you know, I learned from my career at least, don't be afraid to try to create something, develop something wherever you are, whether it's in a firm first, you know, or outside. I mean, even if you're interviewing with a role, if there's something you think you can bring to a role to add to what they're advertising that would be more of interest to you and you think valuable to the company, I really think there's a lot of opportunities for, you know, ambitious and, you know, creative people to create new roles of value that aren't necessarily posted on paper. So I would definitely do that. My job, like I said, this happened after I moved in-house, but there was no such job as mine, and a few companies have, and I invented it, sold it, and it's worked. So, you know, I think there's a lot more opportunity than people think for that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to echo something that Molly said to kind of be open. When I started my government job search, I kind of went with a traditional kind of patent litigation type role that was looking maybe at DOJ civil IP or the PTO Solicitor's Office. Those are kind of the jobs I had in mind. But you know, if you kind of browse through the various patent and technology related jobs, there's a ton of them in the government. I mean, I had no idea that my job existed before I applied for it. The other services all have patent or intellectual property attorneys. The various agencies also have those. The ITC has a lot of patent related jobs. So there's a lot of opportunities out there. You just kind of have to be open, both, you know, type of work you're doing and also geographically, if you're interested in that. And the other piece of advice I would give is to, at least for the government jobs, to be ready to have your resume put together, your cover letter, your bar, you know, your letter of certificate of good standing, your bar card if you need those. Because a lot of these government jobs, they have a very specific hiring time. And so it'll open on this day and close on this day. If you don't make the close date, you're not in contention for that job. If they just hired at the Air Force a similar position to mine, and I think it was open for 2 weeks. So if you didn't happen to see it and have your information ready, you miss out on that opportunity. And with the government jobs, sometimes it can take a lot of different applications before you finally arrive at a place that has a job available and will move fast enough to kind of make everything work. So.
Okay. Well, I think we have a few minutes left to open the phone lines up for any questions that anyone in the audience has. If you have any, we'd love to take your questions now. We'll give you a few minutes to do that.
Thank you, Lauren. And for the participating audience, if you have a question that you would like to ask the panel, to unmute your line, press *6 and then state your question.
I know you have questions, so.
We just answered everything.
I have so many questions that we didn't get to, so I'm sure someone has questions. I'll throw in another one if no one asks any. No takers?
Everyone's so happy in their law firm job.
Or
government job.
Well, I'll throw out one and we'll wait and see if anyone else has any other questions. But I think that everyone clerks. I think everyone clerks on the federal circuit, too.
Not me, actually.
Not you? Did you clerk elsewhere or no?
I did not clerk. And actually, it's a good question because it's one of those things. Now I look back and probably didn't need to have done it, but
I will say when I was looking, you know, at other opportunities, it would have been something I wish I had done.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, you know, whether everyone thought their clerkship was a valuable addition to your career and what you, is it the skills that you developed while clerking, the network, thing that you did?
Everything. Yeah. I think it was, all of those things I think was an extraordinarily valuable experience. And I think the other thing is it's really lucky if you can get a clerkship and, you know, the Federal Circuit is great and there are lots of great clerkships out there beyond the Federal Circuit. There are lots of district courts. There are lots of agencies, exactly, administrative law judges. There are magistrate judges. There are just lots of opportunities out there. I know people who clerk for foreign courts. And so don't limit yourself to just the Federal Circuit or any other sort of small category.
Yeah, especially if you're in D.C. There's so much here in D.C. with all of the agencies and everything being local. So there's a lot of opportunity.
Northern District?
Yeah, definitely.
Eastern District. Privilege and honor, good networking.
I concur. It was fantastic experience. So, and it's helped professionally and personally.
We did talk a little bit about how it may limit your immediate move to government because of the OPM-related
salary.
Oh, that's right. We were talking about that before the webcast started. But if anyone wanted to kind of expand on that, I think the recommendation was you do a clerkship to go into private practice before jumping into a different government agency. Is that right?
Yeah, that can be helpful.
I can't remember what the rule is exactly. When I was leaving the Federal Circuit, I had considered going to the Sisters Office of PTO, and I was explicitly told by the PTO, qualified, love to have you, but don't, because we can't pay you what you should be paid here because of OPM rules that limit what they can do from one government job to another. And you're not making a lot of money as a clerk. It is a privilege and honor to serve. So the comment I got might have been, I can't remember if it was back in time, a friend or colleague at the PTO said, go to private practice, come back, so that the rule doesn't apply.
Right. Yeah, and it makes a big difference. But again, there are jobs that aren't available if you, we're at a law firm, so.
Right, certain fellowships and the things that you talk about.
Yeah, depends on the job.
Are there any other questions? Well, if not, we've thoroughly enjoyed putting this presentation on for you. If you have any comments or feedback for us, please feel free to reach out to me or Jim or anyone else at SCBA, and hopefully we can do more of these in the future, and you can hear from other practitioners who have other experiences beyond the law firm. So thank you all for joining us. Thank you to our four panelists. It's been a great conversation, and thank you again.
Thank you.